live from New York City. It's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, on location. I'd like to welcome all of you today. We're going to, of course, start our program with the latest on health and healing, giving you state-of-the-art information from peer-reviewed journals and respected scientific institutions that simply never make the mainstream media. Then we're going to some audio clips, and one in particular. I mentioned at the beginning of the year that I would be doing more programs challenging the existing polemic within the feminist movement and trying to bring a form to spiritual feminist voices, especially spiritual activist feminist voices, those who do not start off by seeing all the problems as male-oriented, as everything being a patriarchy, but rather seeing whatever needs to be challenged with inequality, looking for the truth of it, and then resolving it. After all, the whole idea should be that men and women should have equality in all things and be able to live long, healthy, happy lives together, not fighting each other. Today, I'll continue with that series where a feminist comes to terms with the men's rights movement, something you never hear about. Casey Jay, J-A-Y-E, will give a discussion of that. Also, I didn't have a chance yesterday just to play Roger Walters condemning the Syrian airstrikes and condemning the white helmets, something that no other personalities that I have seen have come forward to do. And also, there was a beating in the Mesa Police Department. And I posted it for one reason. On the one hand, there is a whole discussion about why people are angry at the police, and it's understandable. I just want to give this in a more balanced perspective. You will hear the commentary. It's a short 3-minute commentary about an African-American male talking on the telephone, and then the police surround him, and he hangs up the phone, and immediately he's beaten, and he's putting up no resistance. He has his hands in the air. He's knocked down. And then once he's down on the ground, he's continued to be beaten. All the other police stand around and watch. Here is our question. Is this a condemnation of the environment for the police? Is this what the police are supposed to be doing? Does this legitimize, then, the anger of so many people about the police, when what we don't see are how many police would not engage in this, would stop it or challenge it? Where are the good police? And why aren't we hearing their stories? Because anytime I see where someone, a police officer, has done the right thing, I post that. And so we're getting to a point where we have to ask, why are there so many people of color attacked, brutalized, killed, who have done nothing wrong? And yet, even with that one case out in, that was also, by the way, in Mesa, I believe it's Arizona, either Arizona or New Mexico, where a man was on the ground, on his knees, hands in the air, so he was shot repeatedly, and the police officer was not convicted. Why aren't they not convicted? When if a non-police officer did the same thing, they would immediately be convicted and sentenced to life imprisonment or death. These double standards of behavior. So that's going to be part of our talkbacks segment today. And also talk back on why is it more celebrities have not educated themselves about the truth about Syria and regime change, the fact that Assad has not been shown or proven to have committed any of the poison gas attacks against his own people, and that the White Helmets are a terrorist organization to which we, the American people, have funded over $500 million, $500 million, for people who kill people who are terrorists, who are propagandists. And we've exposed that. We were the first media in the United States to expose it. and we've done so 23 times with guests from the war zone talking about this. Why is the media, why is the left not on this? Why? That's a question. You have a chance to share your points of view. I've chosen no guests today just so that we can deal in greater depth with this and some commentaries I'll be doing as well. But we always start with the latest on health and healing. And this comes from University of Pennsylvania. And what they found was research finds a tipping point for large-scale social change. Now, this is not specifically about health, but I felt it was very important. And here's what they're saying, that when the size of a minority committed to social change reached 25%, it was consistently able to establish a new behavioral norm in the larger group, a finding that its implications for behavior in the workplace and online in our communities. Now, let's use the obvious case. When organizations turn a blind eye to sexual harassment in the workplace, how many people need to take a stand before the behavior is no longer seen as normal? So according to this new paper published in Science, there is a quantifiable answer. Roughly 25% of people need to take a stand before large-scale social change occurs. The idea of a social tipping point applies to standards in the workplace and any type of movement or initiative. So, how does this apply to health? If we can start with church groups or any religious group and show that the congregation as a whole goes on a healthy eating protocol and the congregation has remarkable improvements and we publish that, we film it, we get it out into the internet, and then all the church groups begin to communicate with one another. That's their responsibility. They can't be a part of it if they're not willing to share consistently the positive impact. Could you imagine how long it would take before the majority of religious congregations in the United States realize that to help with diabetes and cancer and obesity and heart disease and stroke and dementia, they have the whole support system of their congregation. They'll have a protocol. Now, I've done this. I did it with the African-American church up in White Plains, the Seventh-day Adventists. And for 6 months, our crew, Luann Panessi, John Q, we went up there and showed them how to exercise, took them on power walking, how to do push-ups and sit-ups and light weights, gave them self-empowerment messages, and gave them a healthy diet. At the end of 6 months, at least 95% of the people who were in the protocol, which was 90% of the congregation, lost massive amounts of weight. Massive amounts of blood sugar came down into normal, yet they didn't share it with anyone. Okay, they benefited, end of story, and then hopefully they continued, but we need now to share the message. At the height of the Vietnam movement, under 1% of the American population protested. Most people, unfortunately, saw the Vietnam War as like John Wayne in a war movie, until their daughters and sons came back in body bags or mangled. Then it became personal. Only then did they become concerned. The feminist movement, under 0.5%. The civil rights movement. Are you aware that at the height of the civil rights movement, under 1% of African Americans participated? Hard to imagine. So on the one hand, we can make a difference with a tiny minority of at least 1%. But if we want the paradigm to shift completely, they're saying it takes 25%. Now, right now, I'm doing a series along with our scholars and residents, including led by Richard Gale, where we're challenging Wikipedia, and after that Google, and after that Facebook, that they are credible, unbiased, open source encyclopedia for truth. On some areas, that indeed may be the truth. But they have over 126,000 editors. We are now finding out from our investigation, which is the first investigation done on this sacred cow, that they're embedded inside of Wikipedia. There are groups called the well, they believe in scientism, which I do not. It's nonsense. But also, these are called the skeptics. And these are the ultra, ultra-orthodox believers. Now, if you want to know what scientific medicine is, just imagine speaking with anyone on any topic where they are an ultra, ultra-conservative orthodox thinker. Try to get a new idea in. Not going to happen. Try to convince them that what they're doing is wrong. Never going to hear it. Try to ask them to hear what you're saying or proving. They're closed to it. So evidence-based medicine says we invite all ideas. We invite all people to have a voice. And if you can show us in a reasonable way that it can be replicated, then we will incorporate it. So these are the people, the ultra-Orthodox skeptics who control everything involving health or medicine and in other areas as well, as we're finding out. So imagine if we just keep churning out high-quality, scholarly, informed articles, there's going to be a point where we believe, it may take a year, may take 2 years, where enough people say, wow, I didn't know there was that much bias. I didn't know that their bias was preventing me from something that could save my life or improve the quality of my health. So I'm not going to use them as a source anymore. Stop funding them. Stop using them. So this gives me a great deal of hope, just like with climate change. Right now, by the most optimistic result I can find, 99% of all Americans are completely disconnected from the outcome of climate change. Totally disconnected. Yet if you met them at a conference and said, they'll say, I'm an environmentalist, I'm concerned about, you know, global warming. At the same time, they frequently are eating a hamburger. Well, that's contributing to it. That's the cognitive disconnect. They talk it, they don't walk it. How many times have you heard people say, we believe in free speech, especially Pacifica, but then it doesn't because I've been censored, others have been censored. So it's a lie. So when do we lie, accept the lie? This is Orwellian. This is 1984. You know, all the news, it's fit to print. For the Orthodox community, yeah, in New York Times, but not for the rest of us. But there's been no sustained campaign that broadens it up in such a way that involves showing deconstruct the existing paradigm piece by piece. It won't be done all at once. It won't be done with one debate. It won't be done with one article, one film. But in time, it can be. Now, I'm going to ask the people to start today two ways. One, I'd like for you to go to prn.fm, then go to where you'll see a series of these Wikipedia articles, including the one, the bio that I never put up there, and every single line in there is a lie. But then you wouldn't know that if you didn't see my lawyers deconstructing everything they said by this Stephen Barrett that they're using as a, quote, qualified source. He's not qualified as a source. He's been completely discredited. But you wouldn't know that. Read it, educate it, download it, and share it to every single person you have, every friend you have, share it. Then let's start a conscious campaign to stop the drugging of our children. I have a multi-award-winning documentary. It's called The Drugging of Our Children. It's up on Gary and All YouTube. Download it, watch it, and share it. This is how we go from 1% to 2% or 3%, and we start working our way up that ladder, making more and more people aware of it. You'd be hard put to watch that documentary and not realize why most of the mass shooters were on medications and what those medications do to make you a psychotic and paranoid, delusional, and completely intemperate to anyone else's feelings, so therefore you could walk in and kill someone. But you're not going to know that unless you see the evidence, hear the story. So today, let's start with The Drugging of Our Children. Please download it, watch it at your leisure, then send it out everywhere you possibly can. Based upon this construct that we can make a change, but it's got to be 25%. It may take time. That's all right. least we'll get there. Now, some good news on health. You hear me talk about the mitochondria. Mito, M-I-T-O, chondria, C-H-O-N-D-R-I-A-L. And when we don't have enough mitochondria working, it becomes dysfunctional. Now, from Northwestern University, published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science, that contributes to kidney disease. Kidney disease is on the increase in the United States. And what happens when you speak with someone who has kidney disease? Almost always, they're fatigued. The receptor, estrogen-related receptor gamma, regulates mitochondrial metabolism and was also found in unusually low levels in patients with chronic kidney disease, pointing to its importance in healthy kidney function. So the mitochondria are the power plants of the cell, breaking down nutrients and converting them to chemical energy used in a variety of processes. Mutagens in mutations in the mitochondria can reduce their effectiveness, causing dysfunction in organs with high energetic demands. Your heart, your kidneys, and your brain are three examples. Why do you think that with every protocol I give with a person with heart disease or any form of brain or central nervous system problem, multiple sclerosis, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, ALS, I always start by rebuilding the mitochondria, PQQ, NAD, and L-carnosine, and resveratrol, and all the other nutrients that are known, phosphatidylserine, glycerol, phosphocholine. They are proven to rebuild the mitochondria and to protect the cells, and especially the cells' proteins from unraveling, which are the telomeres. So we want to have more electrolytes in the body. We want to have more of the molecules, for example, beet juice, great for the mitochondria. Grape juice, good also. Having green vegetable juices, terrific. The Institute of Science and Technology, which is in Austria, and well as Harvard University, did a study about what it means to be humble. Why do people make anonymous donations? And why does the public perceive this as admirable? Why do we downplay our interest in a potential partner if we risk missing out on a relationship? So a team of scientists at Harvard and at the Science and Technology Institute engaged in this study. And their new model is the first to include the idea that hidden signals, when discovered, provide additional information about the sender. They use this idea to explain under which circumstances people have an incentive to hide their positive attributes. People often take actions that may be costly at first, but lead to reputational benefits in the long run. However, if good reputations are important, why are there numerous situations in which people hide accomplishments or good characteristics, like when we donate anonymously? Similarly, we often emphasize subtlety in art or fashion, avoid appearing overeager or otherwise obscure something positive. Why do others consider this behavior commendable? The team's key insight into this social puzzle is that bearing a signal, meaning obscuring information, is a signal in and of itself. What this means in just lay language is it pays to be humble and modest. The person who does the most and asks the least in return is that person. The person who cares about others without needing thank yous or rewards is that person. The person that will look after others' interests frequently before they do their own is that person. All of us have grown up frequently with parents who gave so much to us, and we should never forget that they cared about us. Did we pass on that message? Did we understand it? Did we understand what sacrifice is? That's a very humbling experience. When I was once I was dating this woman, and on the very first date, this back in the 80s, she said to me, "Why would you be interested in me? I have two kids, you know." And I said, "Well, because for one thing, you're going to be a lot more humble than someone who's never had a kid, never changed a diaper, never had to stay up all night for someone, never had to be there when they had a cough, a cold, a flu, never had to comfort them, never had to make sure that they, your responsibilities was to make sure that everything they needed was taken care of, frequently before you took care of yourself. It's a whole lot easier and more enjoyable dealing with people who come from a humble but self-confident background. I love self-confidence. I love people who are confident to try something. Always, 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 in everything we do, we fail initially. That's fine. What's our lesson? You know, I'm a runner. I'm an athlete. And when people see at the end of a race that I've taken first place, and they say, "Well, that must have been easy." "Oh, no, it wasn't. You have no idea what it was like training and finding rabbits." Now, these are people who are extremely fast, faster than I am. And you see how long you can stay behind them. And they're talking and you're dying. You're trying to breathe and they're just chatting along and they're like cheetahs running. And that's a humbling experience. But only by doing that do you gain self-confidence you can grow, because one day you're finding that you can run longer behind him, and then one day you've ran clear around the park 20 feet behind him and you're not breathing, and you know that they're allowing you to follow behind them, and you're willing to pull off their energy. That gains you self-confidence. But you always realize there's always someone faster, someone smarter, someone who has their own unique talents. You have yours. And therefore, just keep everything in perspective. Then you look at Madonna and you look at Lady Gaga, and they have to do these ornate and outrageous outfits, including the demeanment of, and just base morality, where they take the meat of an animal and make it into a dress. What does that say about the person? Well, so just be aware, humility we all can appreciate, and especially people who don't draw attention to themselves, we don't miss that. I never forget the small gestures people make. You pay attention to the small gestures, especially when they didn't have to. You never forget the person that gives from the heart with no ulterior motive. And you don't want to be around the person that everything they do to leave the price tag on, that's just a metaphor to remind you what they're giving you. Oh, then they're going to expect a whole lot in return. Oh, just as an aside, I'll wait for a moment, and then I just want to give a few more, then I'm going to give you another thing to call in about. From St. Michael's Hospital, there is a look at what can help lower the bad cholesterol, the LDL. And it's barley. And barley lowers not one but two types of bad cholesterol in the study published in the European Journal of Clinical Nutrition. In fact, there were 14 separate clinical studies conducted in 7 countries, including Canada, that's where that university is, or hospital. And it was the first study to look at the effects of barley and barley production on the LDL cholesterol and the non-HDL cholesterol. So it lowered it. That's good. And a nice barley hot cereal in the morning is terrific. Or barley cooked and then put into a salad is also excellent. And rosemary extract can improve brain trauma, induced oxidative and cognitive deficits. This is from Kunming Medical University in China. So a simple herb, rosemary. So this was important. We're always seeing, once again, things that we never thought would make a difference, making a difference. And a high-quality diet could reduce cancer survivors' risk, according to University of Florida study. Now, what do we know? We know that cancer survivors who consumed a balanced, nutrient-dense diet had a 65% lower risk of dying from cancer than survivors who ate a poor quality standard American diet. And that's what they found. High in vegetables and fruits and whole grains and grain proteins, that's what made the difference. And this is in the peer-reviewed journal of the National Cancer Institute, Cancer Spectrum. So that's the latest on health and nutrition. Tomorrow I'm going to talk about ginger on our next program, and also how polyphenols reverse endothelial dysfunction in diabetics, and also how fructose causes genetic change in the brain that's not good and increases your risk of disease. Remember this for every soft drink. But all that's coming on our next program. Let's take a break and come right back. Please stay with us. I want to play an audio clip now. This is the viral video of Mesa police beating an innocent person for no reason. All the other police just stand there and watch. There are about 7 police around him. He had done nothing. But then they charged him for resisting arrest. Well, what crime did he commit or suspect of committing that he would have been susceptible to being arrested? None. This is like asset forfeiture, which we're tolerating, which we accept, and we shouldn't. So you arrest a person who's committed no crime, is suspected of committing no crime, but because they might have put their hands over their head, now they're resisting arrest. This is how absurd it's gone. At what level of police brutality, of victimizing and really hurting, frequently killing an innocent person do we go before we realize the entire system, our complete criminal justice system, is wrong at every level? Listen in, please. It's a short audio clip.
This is 33-year-old Robert Johnson. He's unarmed, he's nonviolent, he's on a cell phone making a call as these 4 officers repeatedly harass him. Now, these officers are from the Mesa Police Department. They're here on a domestic disturbance call. They frisk Johnson, then they tell him to move over to the wall. He complies, but things take a grim turn when he gets off the phone. Now, if this video looks like totally unprovoked attempted manslaughter to you, well, that's because it is. That's exactly what happened. And how did Mesa Police Department react to the surfacing of this video? Predictably.
Mesa police say he was arguing and refused to sit down when they told him to.
And then they proceeded to put the 4 officers on paid leave. Now, let me tell you something. These people are cowards. They're not here to serve. They're not here to protect. These subhuman mistakes are here to enact vengeance on society because of their personal inferiority complex by abusing the trust given to them by those who pay their salary. There's no fear here. It's just pure hatred. It's pure anger. And this is why we criticize police brutality, not purely from a racial standpoint. Race is just the component that compounds the likelihood of someone becoming a victim. After all, this is the same department that Phillips Brailsford was an officer at when he executed Daniel Shaver, an innocent, unarmed white man begging for his life on his hands and knees. Philip was acquitted and was fired from Mesa Police Department, but not for cold-blooded murder. He was fired for departmental misconduct, for unsatisfactory performance. What happened? Did he not beat suspects hard enough? Was he too easy on them? Now, do you want to know why people hate cops? This is the textbook definition of why. 1, cops start harassing a person they deem a suspect. 2, they wait till he's off the phone to beat the doors off of him. 3, and this is the most important part, not a single one of the other good cops try to stop the bad cop from pummeling the victim's skull even after he is clearly unconscious. 4, the other cops actually end up hogtying the victim, further treating him as less than human. 5, they eventually arrest the victim for suspicion of disorderly conduct and hindering. And finally, 6, these cops get paid leave. They most likely won't be fired, and even if they are fired, they will end up getting a job at another police department, and the cycle of violence will continue. And there are examples of this. Deontay Yarber's murderer, who unloaded 30 bullets into him in a Walmart parking lot, was fired from a previous precinct for blatant racism. This flagrant lack of respect for human lives is what puts police lives at risk. This lack of accountability is why people hate hate cops. This violence that affects all Americans, black and white, is why people hate cops. It's not the people who take a brave stance against this brutality and have the courage to ask for accountability that are causing this problem. It's those who perpetrate this violence and others who allow these cruel acts to continue who truly put police officers' lives at risk. Getting angry at black athletes kneeling when they're kneeling for you is no different than getting mad at the doctor who tells you you have cancer. You have to acknowledge and understand a problem before you can fix it. Because I think we can all agree that it's better to kneel during the national anthem than have a 300-pound cop kneel on your windpipe during a routine traffic stop. I'm Hassan Piker. If you're sick and tired of this hypocrisy, please share this video with your
Okay. So that's one person's view. I'd like yours. What has happened with protect and serve? The Supreme Court has stated that that is not their obligation. They have no legal responsibility to protect you nor to serve you. What about citizen review? That's been a joke. What about changing the entire system, how they're trained? Stop allowing the Israelis to train our police, because we know how the Israelis deal with Palestinians. What are your views? 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. Now we're going to hear Roger Walters condemning Syrian airstrikes and saying white helmets lie. Now, this is at a concert. It's only 60 seconds long, a little hard to hear. But I just want to acknowledge him, because anytime someone takes a stand, it's going to be very unpopular, and it could cost him millions of dollars in income and cause him to be attacked, deserves a moment of respect.
If we were listening to the propaganda of the white helmets and others, we would be encouraged to encourage our governments to go and start dropping bombs on people in Syria. This would be a mistake of monumental proportions.
Roger Walters hit out at the White Helmets group, calling it a fake organization. He added that...
Okay, just very short, but he stood up. Very few people will stand up for something that at the same time, yeah, puts him directly in conflict with the Israeli policies, an apex machine. Now here is a woman, a respected feminist, who took the time to actually look into what the men's rights movement was saying, and here's her perspective.
In 2013, I decided to meet my enemies. I was a 27-year-old award-winning documentary filmmaker and a proud feminist, and I was determined to expose the dark underbelly of the men's rights movement. At that point, all I knew of the men's rights movement was from what I read online, that it's a misogynistic hate group actively working against women's equality. While the vast majority of my previous work was about women's issues, I directed documentaries about reproductive rights, single motherhood, and the need for more girls to get into STEM education. So when I learned that no one had ever documented the men's rights movement in a film before, I saw it as an opportunity to continue fighting for women's equality by exposing those preventing it. So for 1 year, I traveled North America, meeting the leaders and followers of the men's rights movement. I spent anywhere from 2 hours up to 8 hours interviewing each individual men's rights activist, also known as MRA. And I filmed 44 people total. And there's an important rule in documentary filmmaking. As an interviewer, you do not interrupt. So I'm asking questions, and I'm getting their full life story. And in the moment, I didn't realize it. But now, looking back, I can see that while I was conducting my interviews, I wasn't actually listening. I was hearing them speak, and I knew the cameras were recording. But in those moments of sitting across from my enemy, I wasn't listening. What was I doing? I was anticipating. I was waiting to hear a sentence, or even just a couple of words in succession, that proved what I wanted to believe, that I had found the misogynist, the ground zero of the war on women. A couple of times, I thought I had it. There was one men's rights activist that said to me, Just walk outside and look around. Everything you see was built by a man. Ooh, his statement felt anti-women. I felt my jaw clench, but I sat quietly, as a documentarian should, while removing all the space between my upper and lower molars. After my year of filming, I was reviewing the 100 hours of footage I had gathered, replaying and transcribing it, which, believe me when I say, no one will ever listen to you more than someone who transcribes your words. You should write that down. So, I was typing out every word meticulously, and through that process, I began to realize that my initial knee-jerk reactions to certain statements weren't really warranted, and my feeling offended didn't hold up to intense scrutiny. Was that statement about men having built the skyscrapers and the bridges anti-women? I thought, well, what would be the gender reverse scenario? Maybe a feminist saying, just look around. Everyone you see was birthed by a woman. Wow, that's a powerful statement. And it's true. Is it anti-male? I don't think so. I think it's acknowledging our unique and valued contributions to our society. Well, luckily, while I was making the Red Pill movie, I kept a video diary, which ended up tracking my evolving views. And in looking back on the 37 diaries I recorded that year, there was a common theme. I would often hear an innocent and valid point that a men's rights activist would make, but in my head, I would add on to their statement a sexist or anti-woman spin, assuming that's what they wanted to say but didn't. So here are two examples of how that would go. A men's rights activist, an MRA, would say to me, there are over 2,000 domestic violence shelters for women in the United States, but only one for men. Yet multiple reputable studies show that men are just as likely to be abused. I would hear them say, we don't need 2,000 shelters for women. They're all lying about being abused. It's all a scam. But in looking back on all the footage I'd gathered of men's rights activists talking about shelters, and all the blogs they've written, and the video live streams they posted on YouTube, they're not trying to defund women's shelters. Not at all. All they're saying is that men can be abused too, and they deserve care and compassion. Second example, a men's rights activist would say to me, where is justice for the man who was falsely accused of raping a woman? And because of this accusation, he loses his college scholarship and is branded with the inescapable title of rapist. I would hear them say, a woman being raped isn't a big deal. It's as if I didn't hear the word falsely accused of rape. All I heard was he was accused of rape. Of course, rape is a big deal, and all the men's rights activists I met agreed it is a horrible thing to have happened to anyone. I eventually realized what they're saying is they're trying to add to the gender equality discussion, who is standing up for the good-hearted, honorable man that loses his scholarship, his job, or worse yet, his children, because he's accused of something he absolutely did not do? Well, I couldn't keep denying the points they were making. There are real issues. But in my effort to avoid agreeing with my enemy completely, I changed from putting words in their mouth to acknowledging the issue, but insisting they are women's issues. So here are two examples of how that would go. A men's rights activist would say to me, men are far more likely to lose their child in a custody battle. And I would counter, well, because women are unfairly expected to be the caretaker, it's discrimination against women that women get custody more often. Yeah. I'm not proud of that. Second example, An MRA would say to me, men are roughly 78% of all suicides throughout the world. And I would counter with, but women attempt suicide more often. So ha. Ha. It's not a contest, but I kept making it into one. Why couldn't I simply learn about men's issues and have compassion for male victims without jumping at the opportunity to insist that women are the real victims? Well, after years of researching and fact-checking what the men's rights activists were telling me, there is no denying that there are many human rights issues that uniquely or disproportionately affect men. Paternity fraud uniquely affects men. The United States Selective Service, in the case of a draft, still uniquely affects men. Workplace deaths, disproportionately men. War deaths, overwhelmingly men. Suicide, overwhelmingly men. Sentencing disparity, life expectancy, child custody, child support, false rape allegations, criminal court bias, misandry, failure to launch, boys falling behind in education, homelessness, veterans issues, infant male genital mutilation, lack of parental choice once a child is conceived, lack of resources for male victims of domestic violence. So many issues that are heartbreaking if you are the victim or you love someone who is the victim of any one of these issues. These are men's issues, and most people can't name one because they think, well, men have all the rights, they have all the power and privilege. But these issues deserve to be acknowledged. They deserve care, attention, and motivation for solutions. Before making the Red Pill movie, I was a feminist of about 10 years, and I thought I was well-versed on gender equality issues. But it wasn't until I met men's rights activists that I finally started to consider the other side of the gender equality equation. It doesn't mean I agreed with all that they said, but I saw the immense value in listening to them and trying to see the world through their eyes. I thought if I could get my audience to also listen to them, it could serve as a rung on the ladder, bringing us all up to a higher consciousness about gender equality. So in October 2016, the film was released in theaters and articles and critic reviews started to roll in. And that's when I experienced how engaged the media is in groupthink around gender politics. And I learned a difficult lesson. When you start to humanize your enemy, you in turn may be dehumanized by your community. And that's what happened to me. Rather than debating the merit of the issues addressed in the film, I became the target of a smear campaign. And people who had never seen the movie protested outside the theater doors, chanting that it was harmful to women. It certainly is not. But I understand their mindset. If I never made this movie and I heard that there was a documentary screening about men's rights activists that didn't show them as monsters, I too would have protested the screenings or at least signed the petitions to ban the film, because I was told that they were my enemy. I was told that men's rights activists were against women's equality. But all the men's rights activists I met support women's rights and are simply asking the question, why doesn't our society care about men's rights? Well, the greatest challenge I faced through this whole process, it wasn't the protests against my film, and it wasn't how I was treated by the mainstream media, even though it got pretty disgusting at times. The greatest challenge I faced was peeling back the layers of my own bias. It turns out I did meet my enemy while filming. It was my ego saying that I was right and they were subhuman. It's no secret now that I no longer call myself a feminist, but I must clarify, I am not anti-feminist, and I am not a men's rights activist. I still support women's rights, and I now care about men's rights as well. However, I believe if we want to honestly discuss gender equality, we need to invite all voices to the table. Yet this is not what is happening. Men's groups are continually vilified, falsely referred to as hate groups, and their voices are systematically silenced. Do I think either movement has all the answers? No. Men's rights activists are not without flaws, and neither are feminists. But if one group is being silenced, that's a problem for all of us. If I could give advice to anyone in our society at large, we have to stop expecting to be offended, and we have to start truly, openly, and sincerely listening. That will lead to a greater understanding of ourselves and others, having compassion for one another, working together towards solutions, because we all are in this together. And once we do that, we can finally heal from the inside out. But it has to start with listening. Thank you for listening.
Okay. Your thoughts, please. You have a chance now to share your insights. Call us at 888-874-4888. I feel that there are many, many more women who hold those views than those who hold the view that all the problems in the world are men's views, are men's problems. They cause it all. It's just not the case. And yet we have now a culture of permanent victimhood, that no matter what is discussed, a person brings the whole conversation into how they are a victim, no matter who it is. And you cannot get out of the problem if you constantly perceive yourself as the victim of everything. You have to be an optimist. You have to look at the spiritual issue of what is restraining you from happiness and evolving as a human being. I'd like to hear from you, so give us a call. And while you're thinking about calling in, and I'll take your calls as they come in, I want to share some views. I'm sure you've heard of this in the past, where people say, well, our Constitution was meant to be inspired by the Christian philosophies and statements. Simply not true. I'd like to share some insights from Rob Boston from Alternate on this, because I see this all the time, especially in conservative media, radio and television. So to hear the religious right tell it, men like George Washington and John Adams and Thomas Jefferson, and let's throw in James Madison, were 18th century versions of, let's pick a name, Jerry Falwell. I'm sure everyone in this audience has heard of Jerry Falwell, except they were just in powdered wigs, but nothing could be further from the truth. Because unlike many of today's candidates, the founders didn't find it necessary to constantly wear religion on their sleeves. They considered faith a private affair. Contrast them to former Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich, who says he wouldn't vote for an atheist for president because non-believers lack the proper moral grounding to guide the American ship of state. Are you talking, Newt, about when you had an affair with your wife, against your wife? Is that the kind of moral equivalency you're discussing? Texas Governor Rick Perry, who hosted a prayer rally and issued an infamous ad accusing President Barack Obama of engaging in a war on religion, and former Pennsylvania Senator Rick Santorum, whose uber-Catholicism leads him to oppose not just abortion but birth control. There was a time when Americans voted for candidates who were skeptical of core concepts of Christianity, like the Trinity or the divinity of Jesus, or the virgin birth. The question is, could any of them get elected today? Simple question. My personal views? No. Not only could they not get elected today, but almost none of the most important religious characters from history could even get a mention today. They'd be ridiculed. I'll give you a few examples. Let's just start with George Washington. He's considered the father of our country. He was nominally an Anglican, but seemed more at home with deism. The language of the deist sounds odd to today's ears because it's theological system of thought that was, it's no longer in favor. Deists believe in God, but didn't necessarily see him as an active person in being in human affairs. The God of their belief was a God of first cause. He set things in motion, then stepped away. Washington often employed terms, deist terms. His God was a supreme architect of the universe, and Washington saw religion as necessary for good moral behavior, but didn't necessarily accept all of Christians' dogmas. He seemed to have a special gripe against communion and would usually leave service before it was offered. And Washington was widely tolerant of other beliefs. He was the author of one of the great classics of religious liberty, the Letter of Touro Synagogue in 1790. And in this letter, Washington assured America's Jews they would enjoy complete religious liberty in America, not merely toleration in an officially Christian nation. He outlines a vision of multi-faith society where all are free. So stories of Washington's deep religiosity, such as tales of him praying in the snow at Valley Forge, that's nonsense. They are pious legends invented after his death. Never happened. Then you have John Adams, in my personal opinion, one of the smartest of all presidents. The man who followed Washington in office was a Unitarian. Although he was raised a Congregationalist and never officially left that church, Adams rejected the belief in the Trinity and the divinity of Jesus, core concepts of Christian dogma. In his personal writings, Adams makes it clear that he considered some Christian dogma to be incomprehensible. In fact, in February of 1756, Adams wrote in his diary about a discussion he had had with a man named Major Green, and Green was a devout Christian who sought to persuade Adams to adopt conservative Christian views. The two argued over the divinity of Jesus and the Trinity, and questioned on the manner of Jesus' divinity, Green fell back on that old standby, some matters of theology are too complex and mysterious for puny humans to understand, and Adams was not impressed. In his diary, he wrote, "Thus mystery is made a convenient cover for absurdity." Thomas Jefferson was also similar in views. He once said, "I am a sect by myself, as far as I know." But one thing is clear, his skepticism of traditional Christianity is well established. Our third president did not believe in the Trinity, the virgin birth, the divinity of Jesus, the resurrection, the original sin, and other core Christian doctrines. He was hostile to many conservative Christian clerics whom he believed had perverted the teachings of that faith. Jefferson once famously observed to Adams, "And the day will come when the mystical generation of Jesus, by the supreme being of his father in the womb of a virgin, will be classed with the fable of the generation of Minerva in the brain of Juniper." And James Madison and Thomas Paine were the same feeling. So when you hear someone claim with absolute certainty that we are a Christian nation and our founding fathers wanted that to be part of the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and all of our stated and unstated doctrine is simply not true. Now for Diane from New York, you're on. Diane, give us your thoughts, please.
Good afternoon, Gary. I just wanted to make a comment on the woman who did the documentary on men's rights, and that she, in searching for the truth, which was not subjective, but objective for all parties concerned, actually ran into her own demons. And everyone can benefit from watching someone else grow. And it always takes that one pioneer to set the standard, and then things are built from that. And I never personally thought that women could be oppressed by men without men being oppressed on some level, somewhere in society. If not in the workplace, then in the home. I always said that you can't inflict pain unless you're in pain. And I'm glad that this scab is being ripped off of this infected wound, because it needs to drain, and conversations have to happen, and emotions have to be expressed, and healing needs to begin.
Very well said, Diane. I appreciate your input. I'll close the program with a follow-up to what you just mentioned, the scab being pulled off. The task of the real intellectual consists of analyzing illusions in order to discover their causes. That was from Arthur Miller. And it's time that we separated out the illusions of the problems from the reality of the problems so we can get to real solutions. All the best to you. Thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more on our next program. Have a nice day.